It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, as tenure and funding challenges threaten the UW system, some faculty are looking to other schools for jobs, but the professor exodus at schools like UW may not be as severe as people have expected. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, Wisconsin once again finds itself as at the center of the political universe today. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine held a campaign event in Milwaukee this morning. Tonight, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and his running mate Mike Pence will hold an event in Green Bay. Some observers are taking note that Wisconsin's top three Republicans will not be in attendance. Elsewhere on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton appears to have widened her lead over Donald Trump, according to a pair of new national polls, one of which shows her with a 15-point advantage. The polls come after what's been described as a disastrous week for Donald Trump, who publicly sparred with the Muslim parents of a slain American Army captain. Here with us to discuss all the latest developments in the presidential race is Barry Burden, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, big visits today, both tickets showing up in the state. We've talked some back and forth on this show about whether or not Wisconsin is a battleground state at play in November. They're here, so I guess we must be.
They are finally here, though I think we're getting mixed messages. On the one hand, the candidates from both campaigns have finally shown up here now in early August, but there aren't a lot of staff on the ground yet, especially not for the Trump campaign, and we've seen no TV advertising. I think until we see the TV ads start to roll in, it's unclear whether Wisconsin's on the table or off the table in November.
So that's interesting. A visit is kind of cheap and easy, I guess, and it gets you some press, but that sort of sustained effort of having a powerful, organized campaign effort in the state, we're not seeing that.
That's right. I mean, the visit by a candidate does several things. It does whip up your support and hopefully persuade some voters to come to your side. But it's also often paired with a fundraising event. It's a way to meet with local Democrats or Republicans on the ground. And so it has a number of purposes that can be valuable, even in a non-swing state. But advertising is where the real cost is. And when you see campaigns do that, you know something is happening.
Now, Donald Trump having an event in the state, Green Bay, tonight. A lot of people focusing on who's not going to be there. Governor Scott Walker, a Speaker of the House in Wisconsin, Congressman Paul Ryan, Senator Ron Johnson, all citing alternate scheduling needs, things like that, not saying they're intentionally avoiding this. It is a little unusual, though. This is potentially their party's next president of the United States.
It is, and it's a real contrast between the two parties. Today at the Tim Kaine event in Milwaukee, I think also present were the mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, Senator Tammy Baldwin, and other high-profile Democrats. So the kind of unified ticket that the Democrats are running really contrasts with the Trump campaign, which is essentially on its own, especially this week with all the controversy that has really been dragging down the campaign.
And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss here in Wisconsin, Republican, said ultimately he's going to support Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton would be worse. But in saying that, he says, quote, "I'm embarrassed that he's leading our ticket," which is something. That's his own guy, his own party person. This is a long running narrative of Wisconsin Republicans against Donald Trump going back at least to the primaries here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Wisconsin was the last state that Donald Trump lost in the primaries. And it was embarrassing for him. It was really a battle between him and the Republican establishment and conservative talk radio here. And they have not patched up those difficulties from back in April.
And now we're seeing the news this week. Paul Ryan, who was on the show yesterday, who is still supporting Donald Trump and says Trump doesn't have a blank check, but he's got his support. Trump very recently saying he wasn't sure if he was going to endorse Paul Ryan. Now we're getting signals that he might. This is the Speaker of the House. This is the highest ranking elected Republican in the country. What do you make of that back and forth?
I've never seen anything like this, to be honest. Here you've got a member of the House who has his own primary to worry about on Tuesday, but is also Speaker of the House and really the person who speaks for the Republican Party in Washington and oversaw the Republican National Convention just a couple of weeks ago. And a major party nominee who's not on board with him. And so I think this dance is going to continue through November.
Talking to UW-Madison political scientist Barry Burden about the latest in the presidential race as both campaigns show up in Wisconsin today. Let's look at the Democratic side of things and their convention coming in. You had the Bernie Sanders supporters not happy with how things were handled by the Democratic National Committee. emails hacked, released, showing things that made them very unhappy. We're seeing people at the top resigning from the Democratic National Committee. Is that going to hurt Democrats in the way these public rifts are hurting Republicans?
You would think so. It was not a flawless convention for the Democrats. It had a lot of successes. There are a lot of stars in the Democratic Party right now who spoke, including the president and the former president, Bill Clinton, and others. But these little skirmishes, both at the beginning and at the end of the convention, should have marred the message coming out of it. And yet, because the Trump campaign was such a distraction, Democrats, I think, view the convention largely as a success, especially relative to what the Republicans did in Cleveland.
You mentioned former and current presidents now supporting Hillary Clinton. She's got a lot of Democratic firepower at her disposal. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden out campaigning for her. On the Republican side, you have two former Republican presidents alive and well and apparently not campaigning publicly for or not endorsing even Donald Trump. Does that make a difference, though, to voters?
I think it does. I mean, in addition to the two former presidents, the Bushes, who have not endorsed Trump, the two former Republican nominees, both McCain and Romney, have not come to Trump's side either.
And Romney, on the other side, he's really been speaking against Donald Trump.
Very much. And so Trump is without surrogates, essentially. It's him and his running mate who are on the trail together. They can cover two places at once, and that's it. Whereas the Democrats really have a team of people who can be out on the campaign trail in a variety of states simultaneously.
We're seeing a lot of post-convention polls come out this week. For a long time now, we've been saying, okay, looking at polls, it's still too early for them to be that meaningful. Conventions are over. We're about 3 months out. As Hillary Clinton gets these leads in national polls and battleground polls, do we start to take them more seriously now?
Absolutely. We're just at the point where the polls really become meaningful. Political science studies have shown that about 90 days out is where they become very highly predictive of what will happen in the general election. We're almost there, and we passed the conventions. Now, it may be that the debates or something else that happens in September, October will be meaningful, but really the polls now become a better indicator than they have been thus far.
There's a question as to whether the debates will happen. Donald Trump has been arguing that they're up against NFL games in a couple cases, expressing dissatisfaction with this setup. I know it's hard to predict individual behavior, especially with Donald Trump. I think that's fair to say. But is it a given that these debates will happen as planned?
It's not. It's an expectation. But Donald Trump did back out of at least one debate during the primaries, just around the time of the Iowa caucus. So there's precedent for it, and I don't think he felt as though his campaign was hurt by stepping out of that debate. The threat of being in or out of the debate is also a way to distract from other issues, and Trump does tend to move from topic to topic rather quickly. So this one may come back a few times before we actually get to the debates.
What's different for Donald Trump now? Because he generated his share of controversy during the primaries, and clearly it didn't hurt him much. Now, these same kind of things, I don't know if they're different, the topics, or if it's just different now that it's the general election. Why are the things he's doing hurting him where they didn't previously?
The topics are different, that's for sure. But I think it's more a difference between the primary stage and the general election stage that matters. During the primaries, he was running at one point against 15 or 16 other Republicans and really fighting for attention and getting it and not needing very much of the vote to defeat 10 or 12 opponents, whoever was left in the race at that time, and very low turnout in those primaries relative to the attention he will get in the general election. Now the stage is different. You have two parties really, as much as they can, rallying around their nominees, and it's a battle for the presidency. And I think voters and the media take it differently.
What are you watching for next in terms of polling, what we hear from the candidates? What's next in your mind?
All of those things. We'll certainly watch the polling because it'll be settling down to a new equilibrium here this week. Hopefully we'll have some new Wisconsin polls in the next week or so and see how the post-convention bounces have affected our state. I'll be looking to see whether Trump puts together the beginnings of a conventional campaign with staff, field offices, advertising. He's now done some serious fundraising in the month of July.
Right. That was the one bit of good news from the Trump campaign over the last week. Good fundraising totals.
Absolutely. Month. And that looks like what a normal campaign does. And as he's begun to match Clinton in that regard. But it hasn't yet translated to the kind of other things that campaigns conventionally do.
And then a change of tone. Do you expect that from Donald Trump? That's what a lot of leading Republicans are pushing for, saying stop all these side arguments, focus on Hillary Clinton and just Hillary Clinton. Do you think that's going to happen?
I do not. Donald Trump is who he is. He's been this way in public life for decades now. It's part of what led to his success in the primaries. At times, he's tried to tamp back on that style. He warned at one point he would be so presidential it would be boring. That has not happened and doesn't generally work for him as well as, you know, just sort of seat of the pants.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, glad I could be here.
That's Barry Burton, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, with us to talk about the latest in the presidential race as both campaigns show up in Wisconsin today. You're listening to Central Time. Coming up later, it's Food Friday. This week, we'll dig into a summer classic, potato salad. Right now, the University of Wisconsin system has been at the center of an ongoing fight over funding and tenure. The university system is frequently at odds with the state legislature, which has worked to reduce the power of tenure, and we've seen funding cuts to higher education here in the state. Wisconsin is not alone in this, with other states often facing similar challenges. With the ongoing cuts and challenges to tenure, professors and other faculty facing a loss of tenure or reduced paychecks have started looking elsewhere for opportunities. While some professors are leaving their posts, it looks like faculty may not be exiting at as high of a rate as previously thought, especially as universities fight to keep their top talent on board. Lee Gardner joins us now. He's a senior reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's the going theory, isn't it, Lee, that in states with questions over funding, over tenure, a lot of faculty are leaving, looking to leave. What are you seeing at UW and comparable schools around the country?
Well, that's certainly been the rumor and the conjecture that there would be a lot of people leaving. But when I started looking into it, I found that, in fact, there haven't been that many more tenured faculty leaving than there have been in recent past years. But what there has been is a concentrated effort by other schools to recruit faculty who may feel some discontent with how things are going politically in the state. And also all the talk and the conjecture and the discussions about people leaving has had impacts on morale at the universities in the state.
We'll dig a little deeper into that in just a bit. But first of all, obviously here in Wisconsin, we've been focused on what's going on at Wisconsin colleges and universities. How unique is our situation here in Wisconsin, though?
Well, you know, there are a number of states where there have been budget cuts or budget problems, Illinois being a prime example where the university system and indeed, you know, much of the public institutions in the state went without any state appropriations for almost the entirety of the last fiscal year. You know, states like Kansas and Louisiana, there have also been big cuts. So the tenure situation is somewhat unique to Wisconsin, but there are a number of states where you know, there have been problems, there have been controversies, and the discussion about people leaving have been going on.
How much focus is there on, I guess, the rock stars at universities like this, the people who are big names in their field, maybe bringing in lots of grant money, the students come from around the country to study with them? Do they tend to be the focus of efforts to pirate away faculty?
They do. I mean, certainly any faculty member can put him or herself on the job market. But I think most of these recruiting efforts are going to be focused on, you know, top scholars who are going to bring along those research dollars or just, you know, add more prestige to the institutions that want to bring them in. That goes on all the time. But again, I think that what's been borne out is that a lot of those efforts have intensified.
Now, you write that not maybe as many faculty as we might think are leaving a place like UW-Madison in particular, but it's taken a lot of effort from the university itself. What kinds of things have had to happen to keep those faculty on board?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things I found is that while not appreciably more tenured faculty have left, at least according to the last numbers that I saw, but the number of official counteroffers that the university was asked to prepare by faculty who had job offers from elsewhere tripled from the previous year. So clearly there was a lot more discontent, a lot more people looking, maybe a lot more people, frankly, using an offer from another institution as a way to leverage, you know, a little more salary or, you know, a better lab or something like that. You know, several sources told me, including the provost there at the Madison campus, that the university budgeted $16 million just to basically fight poaching efforts to, you know, increase salary, to, you know, add other resources to sweeten the pot to keep top faculty around. They also told me that that's not something they can sustain, you know, for many years if this situation goes on. I mean, with money being tight, $16 million in the overall budget of the institution is not a huge amount, but it's not something they can afford to spend every year just to keep their professors.
Right. Amid budget cuts and tuition freezes, $16 million going for that one thing, a retention, is $16 million that isn't going for something else.
Absolutely.
We're talking about universities in Wisconsin and elsewhere facing budget cuts, changes in tenure here in the state, and whether faculty are looking to jump ship, go elsewhere, what universities are having to do to keep them on board. Lee, you mentioned the issue of morale. What kind of things did you hear from people as you wrote this recent piece?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of people are finding it very difficult to keep their focus, not only because of some of the you know, the political hot buttons that have occupied the legislature and the media, you know, that has certainly taken a big part of the public conversation, but also internally. I mean, you know, people talking about wanting to leave, hearing about other faculty members who are, you know, have applied for other jobs. You know, several people told me that it has just, you know, created this enormous amount of noise on campus, as one person put it, where, you know, doing the jobs that they have to do, which are, you know, considerable jobs, have been made tougher by all this talk and, you know, and frankly, a lot of negativity from some quarters.
And some people who do leave universities do so with some fanfare, writing public pieces. We've talked to some departing UW faculty on this show about why they're leaving. We've also talked to some who are staying about why they stay and why they think it's a good decision for faculty to stay. But is that part of what has attracted so much attention, that people are leaving, writing, and talking about why they're leaving?
Oh, undoubtedly. You know, I mean, the professors leave the institutions where they are now for new institutions all the time, but clearly some faculty members, for one reason or another, often I think as a form of political protest, are making a bigger deal out of it now, and they have an opportunity to say, I'm leaving, and, you know, the tacit implication is, and probably you should too. So, you know, I think that there is something else here other than at work, other than just, like, I'm not happy and I'm leaving. It's an attempt to sort of preach a little bit, I think, and express some displeasure about the situation there in the state.
Of course, most people out there aren't college professors, but a lot of people might be listening thinking, I'm looking at maybe sending my kid to a UW school or a similar school that's facing these challenges, or I'm an alumni of one of these universities. I'm concerned about what's happening to this place that educated me. Does this all ultimately affect what happens, the educational experience for undergrads at a school?
Well, it can. I mean, I would hasten to point out that, you know, the Madison campus is still, by any measure, a really fine university. And, you know, many of the other regional institutions in the state, I mean, you know, students can go there and get a good education. You know, there are a lot of dedicated faculty who are still there and remain there. You know, the biggest challenge, I think, going forward is funding and you know, at least, you know, when you hear from the university's perspective, you know, the biggest challenge they face is being able to appropriately staff their departments to be able to do the work that that they're meant to do. And money is a bigger challenge to being able to do that well than, you know, talk about people leaving, if that makes sense.
Is part of this a public relations issue for universities having to make the case for their benefits for the state, the community, things like that, so that they resolve these conflicts with legislatures, sell their mission to the public better?
Well, you know, several people spoke of their frustration that in the past several years there, university professors have been sort of defined in the public rhetoric as these, you know, these people who get paid these extravagant amounts of money and then don't offer any benefit to the state, or, you know, they don't they are not being it's an issue of respect, but there's this this rhetoric that I think has rankled a lot of people who work very hard. I think they would certainly say so, and I think you can demonstrate that they do to educate the citizens of the state. A lot of the dissatisfaction has not only been with the political side of things, where there have been budget cuts and attacks on tenure, but also this idea that somehow university professors are wasting people's money rather than trying to do their jobs with less money.
If states like Wisconsin and Illinois are seeing other faculty or other universities elsewhere trying to raid their faculty, presumably other places around the country aren't seeing the similar sorts of cuts to funding. What are you seeing as far as trends in higher education funding around the country?
Well, funding, state funding is down almost everywhere. I think North Dakota is one of the few states in the last 6 or 7 years that hasn't been pretty much hasn't cut higher education overall over that period of time. There have been some ups and downs, but the trend overall is downward. And that's been going on in all manner of states, not just states run by Republicans who often have a small government, less tax agenda, which kind of helps contribute to cuts like that. No public institution anywhere, I think, if you hear them talk about it, feels flush with cash, feels like they have enough to do everything they want to do. What they're doing in almost all cases is doing the best they can with what they have, which is, of course, dependent on the legislator and voters to provide.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Lee Gardner. He's a senior reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. He joined us to talk about how public universities in Wisconsin and elsewhere are navigating a changing landscape of tenure rules and funding cuts. Coming up after the news, we'll talk all things potato salad. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get a potato salad, at least one, for every season. And by the way, we'd love to have your feedback on the Ideas Network. That's what you're listening to right now. You'll find a survey on our website at wpr.org/survey. We want to know how and why you listen to the Ideas Network. Again, you can do that at wpr.org/survey. Thanks for listening. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's time for our weekly roundup of the top news from around the state. This week, we'll talk about the news that some of the wealthiest Wisconsinites haven't owed state income taxes for years, plus a mysterious clown in Green Bay. First, it's time for Food Friday, and this week, we're looking at a summer favorite that our next guests say can be enjoyed all year long, potato salad. You might remember back in 2014 when a potato salad-themed Kickstarter project went viral. Its creator, Zach Brown, was looking for $10 to make a batch of potato salad. Then the internet took over, and his potato salad went viral. Over $55,000 later, the Kickstarter became a full-blown potato salad phenomenon, resulting in a few thousand people coming out to a benefit dubbed Potato Stock to sample the goods. The story doesn't end there. Zach Brown has a new potato salad cookbook with a variety of recipes that can be enjoyed in each and every season. He joins us now along with Teresa Blackburn, who's a food stylist, blogger, and recipe developer and tester. They're the co-authors of the new book, The Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook, 24 Delicious Recipes. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Teresa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Zach, let's start with you and the Kickstarter story. This is a big thing, I remember, a couple of years back. And I guess it started as a joke between you and your friends. You're having a party, a potato salad themed party. Ha ha, we'll do a Kickstarter for $10. What happened?
Oh, well, it blew up. Yeah, it got out of control pretty fast. Let me see. We posted this thing to Facebook. We thought it was funny. I think I had this idea that if I got a few friends to kick in $10, we'd have enough money to have a party, buy some beer. And I like I So I posted the thing to Kickstarter, and I went to the gym. And when I came back from the gym, I had a missed call from CNET. The whole afternoon was just responding to reporter inquiries and giving interviews. It got out of hand like within 3 or 4 hours.
So eventually you ended up raising not $10, but $55,000. What was it like watching that add up and ending up on TV and radio and print and internet interviews all over the place?
I remember one Sunday night, it was the first weekend after the Kickstarter launched, and I ended up not sleeping, and I just sat on the couch refreshing my Twitter feed and watching people sort of wake up all over the world and tweet about potato salad. And I think there was never more than 30 seconds that would go by without some tweet about the potato salad Kickstarter. So it was just a weird, frenetic time. It just couldn't really understand what was happening. I remember somebody saying, going into that weekend, like, you're going to make $1,000 on this. This is absurd. You're going to get to the end of this, and you're going to have $1,000. And when we got to the end of the day on Monday, and we're up to, I think it was 34, we were shocked. We literally did not know what to think. Up was down. Cats and dogs were raining from we're getting along.
And Zach, ultimately you ended up, as we said, $55,000. You decided that was more than you needed to make potato salad. You wanted to do some good with this money. What did you end up doing?
Yeah, so we got connected to a place here called the Columbus Foundation, and the Columbus Foundation manages funds for philanthropists. So you put your money in the Columbus Foundation, they manage and grow it for you, and then help connect you to nonprofits in need. So we started a thing called the Potato Salad Fund, and it pays out to nonprofits working to end hunger and homelessness here in Central Ohio.
Well, let's get to the food now. And Teresa, let's bring you in here. There's this this idea to make this potato salad cookbook, drawing from this crazy Kickstarter thing. I can think of about one potato salad recipe until I read your book. Was it a challenge to come up with 20-plus recipes for potato salad?
Well, it was at first, but I had to think about 2 days, and I came up with all 24 in about 2 days, because it was like you started thinking about potato salad, and it grew and grew and grew, and then let's do this kind and that kind. So, no, it was actually pretty easy, and it was incredible amount of fun.
Let's talk about your basic number one potato salad recipe. This is the one you start the book with, the classic. And this is something like Zach was trying to make with that $10 Kickstarter. Talk about what goes into a classic potato salad, Teresa.
Well, I grew up in the South, and there was no meal in the summer from about May till October that did not have potato salad in it. And it was always just your basic thing, potatoes, mayonnaise, pickles, salt and pepper. It was very, very, cooked eggs, nothing fancy. So I took this basic idea that I was very familiar with and kind of launched it into, I wanted all these recipes to be, a little like modernizing the concept of the potato salad, and which is what Zach's fundraiser is. It's like a modern way to raise funds. And so I just started with the basic, and then I added, other items that I just particularly liked. And these were recipes that appealed to me, especially all of these. And, using balsamic vinegar and radishes to give it some crunch and just kind of bring it up into the current, culinary world.
Yeah, the balsamic surprised me a little, Teresa. And also, I didn't know about this pickle. Yeah, there's pickles, sure. And pickle juice, is that common in a basic potato salad?
It is. It is. It was in the where I grew up. Everybody's potato salad can be a divider and a uniter, depending on what part of the country you're from. So, yeah, and where I come from, yes, it was definitely pickle juice and pickles and eggs.
We're talking about potato salad with Teresa Blackburn and Zach Brown. Their new cookbook is the Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook, 24 Delicious Recipes. Zach, let's talk about that. If your Kickstarter had been for, macaroni salad or tuna salad or something, do you think it would have done as well? Was it something special about potato salad that captured people's attention?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's one I hadn't really considered before. You know, I don't know. I think that there was. I think that potato salad really has a an elevated place in sort of cookouts in general, but in the Midwest, 4th of July. So it was. I think that was July 2nd or July 3rd that we launched the Kickstarter, and
so you caught the right time.
We caught the right time, and something Teresa said just now that stood out to me that I had also not considered before is this idea of potato salad as a uniter as well as a divider, that you would have these groups that formed in the comment section of the Kickstarter, people arguing what counts as potato salad, people jumping on. At one point, people wanted to create bracelets for Team Mayonnaise and Team Vinegar. because there are groups of people that believe that it's got to be vinegar based, and there are groups of people that believe that it's got to be mayo based. And you know, if for something to go viral and to last on the internet, there needs to be some level of controversy. There needs to be some level of debate. And this definitely had that. And I don't know how much of it had to do with people fighting each other over different types of potato salad, but it definitely didn't hurt.
Well, I want to ask both of you, Zach. Given your druthers, are you team mayo or team vinegar?
Oh, I'm team potato salad. I like it all.
Either way. And Teresa, do you go? I mean, the mayo sounds like it's in your background.
Very much so. We don't do any meals without mayonnaise down here. But yeah, I'm a vinegar person at this point in my life.
Well, we've got a recipe featured. I think we've got a link already on our Central Time Facebook page, Teresa, the Chipotle corn potato salad, which sounds fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about what goes into that one?
Oh, my God, that one is just great. It is, you know, I was trying to think of things to do, like different types. I opened up my cabinet in my kitchen, and there was a jar of chipotle peppers. I thought, okay, this will be good. So it's got fresh corn, not cooked, anything, just cut off the cob, you know, a good sweet corn. And then it's got the chipotle peppers, which are very, very spicy. And they're the ones that you buy in the jar everywhere, and they're chipotle peppers with adobo sauce. And they are really hot. So I put in the recipe, you could use 2 to 4 tablespoons, depending on how hot you like it. I mean, I go with the 4. I just made this for the 4th of July, and it's got lime juice, fresh corn, adobo sauce, chipotle peppers, and then these red skin potatoes. So it's got kind of a twist. I try to make these recipes very international and national so that they're influenced by all kinds of cuisine. And this one was obviously, you know, Mexican more influenced or Hispanic Latino influenced recipe. It's really good.
It was my favorite.
Yeah, that was one of the ones I would definitely want to try from the cookbook among yeah. many others. Well, we're talking right now with Zach Brown and Teresa Blackburn. They're co-authors of the Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook. You can join in to this edition of Food Friday at 800-642-1234. Are you a potato salad fan? Mayo or vinegar? I know a big German heritage in Wisconsin. Is potato salad a vinegar-based substance where you come from? Do you make it at home? Is it a summertime favorite, a cookout favorite, a grilling side dish, or do you eat it all year long? Do you have recipe tips or questions for our guests? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page and find that recipe we were just talking about for Chipotle corn potato salad. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking this week about potato salad and lots of different kinds of potato salad. Our guests are Zach Brown and Teresa Blackburn. Their new book is The Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook. You might remember Zach as the guy who raised $55,000 for some potato salad on Kickstarter. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your views on potato salad? Love it? Hate it? Mayo, vinegar, what do you do to jazz it up when you cook it? Do you have questions about making potato salad more interesting? Maybe for something you got going on this weekend. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Leslie in Elgin, Illinois. Leslie, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, I just want you to know I'm a Mayo girl all the way. I'm from the South, kind of Kentucky area, and it's a Mayo thing in my family. And I've actually taken to growing potatoes in my yard just to make potato salad in the summer. But I replace my pickles with capers, and I love it.
Where'd you get that idea, Leslie?
I had capers, and I didn't have any pickles or pickle juice one day. And I thought, you know what? How bad could it be, right? They're like baby pickles. And so I just went crazy, and I love it. I actually do it on purpose now.
Necessity is the mother of invention. Leslie, thank you so much. It's versatile, isn't it, Teresa? You can. It's kind of hard to make potato salad really bad, or maybe it's easier than I think. I don't know. It's pretty versatile stuff, isn't it?
Yes, it's very versatile. And on all of these recipes, if you don't have pickles, capers are a fabulous idea. If you don't have mayonnaise, use a salad dressing, like a creamy Caesar salad dressing. You can do whatever you like. Just, they're very adaptable.
Leslie, thanks. That's a great suggestion. And Zach, I don't know, are you a food guy, or has this potato salad quest made you into a food loving person?
Well, I've been eating and enjoying food for a very long time.
Well, sure.
I just moved into a house with a larger kitchen, so maybe I'll get into doing some more food stuff. But no, I've not been a food guy. I for 3 months last year was eating, I don't know if you guys have covered Soylent, the stuff that, is like the I don't know, it's like a protein shake you drink all day long and you don't eat other food.
It's so, food product.
That's right. It's food product. So, I cook a little bit, but I wouldn't call myself a food guy.
Gotcha. Let's get back to our callers now. Peter is on the line in Marquette County. Peter, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask a question. My grandmother's potato salad recipe involved boiling her potatoes and then marinating them overnight in a vinegar solution of some strength. And then, of course, being for peace and reconciliation, would add mayonnaise the next day. I was wondering if you had a recipe that reflected that at all.
And Peter, before we let you go, can I ask, what's your grandmother's ethnic heritage, if I may ask? Is this a Germanic thing with the vinegar?
Indeed. She was a Pennsylvania Dutch.
Okay. All right. Peter, thank you so much for that. So, Teresa, the vinegar is in it. The potatoes are marinated. The mayo comes later. Do you have any hybrids like that?
One of the things I learned working on this book and all these recipes is that depending on the type of potato you're using, like some potatoes are very waxy, so you really don't need any kind of vinegar when you're cooking them. But I cooked a lot of these. You'll notice within the recipe, some of the potatoes I cooked in like a Yukon Gold. It's a more fluffy, looser, you know, not as compact texture. And they oftentimes, for potato salad, need a little bit of vinegar. So I threw some in the water when they're actually cooking. So that kind of goes back to what the caller is saying, is that she may have been using a potato that was more like a baking potato or a Yukon Gold and not one of the real waxy, like a red potato. And sometimes, but I mean, I like that idea of soaking them. That just adds another layer.
Peter, thanks so much for that call. And Zach, do you get this a lot? People have potato salad stories, family stories, things like that for you once they know you're the potato salad guy?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, people love to talk about potato salad with me. I think there is sometimes an expectation that I'll be an expert. I try to dispel that as quickly as possible. This book is largely the work of Teresa and our other two co-conspirators, Jay Spinks and Danielle Atkins, and they did a really good job of making me look good.
And some great photos in there, too, actually. These look
beautiful photos.
Really tasty. Well, we'll go back to our callers. A lot of people want to talk about potato salad at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in Rochester, Minnesota. Susie, hi.
Hey there. How are you doing?
Good. What's your potato salad story?
Well, you know, I was raised on fairly good potato salad, but in the last 20 years, my mom kind of lost the touch. And I always thought it was the mustard that was missing. And, you know, I would offer then to make the potato salad. I got it, and everybody kind of liked it. But I am wondering why we don't use a little bit more of the stone-grown mustards or some of the whole grain. I just had a great whole grain us add a little beer kind of mustard, you know, that kind of mustard in it. What's the take on that?
Well, before we get an answer, Susie, I just want to know, is there tension in the family over potato salad gate here?
No, we're pretty subtle and passive aggressive.
Okay.
We don't talk
good.
About it much, but I just offer.
All right. You know, you're a good Midwestern family, Susie. Thank you so much. So, Teresa, mustard selection and potato salads. What have you tried?
I mean, I like all the different kinds of mustard. I will admit I am not a huge mustard fan. I mean, I like it, but I think it has to be used very judiciously. And whenever I've used in the cookbook, usually I use a Dijon mustard because it's just more mild. But you could, you know, you could substitute like a stone ground or a German mustard. You could do, you know, some of the new hot mustards. Like I think there's a Chipotle mustard. So you can use any of those. It's just it was probably due a lot to particular, you know, my particular taste buds. But I kind of like a light touch with the mustard.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Teresa Blackburn and Zach Brown, authors of the Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook. Zach, family disputes, I guess, family rivalries over potato salad. Does this come up often?
None. No, we were always a family to go get the. We would get the stuff at the store, you know, the yellow sort of pudding looking potato salad. That's our style.
I'll eat that just as happily too. Back to our callers now with Susan in La Crosse. Susan, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about, Susan?
Well, I tell you, I've been cooking for about 40 years, and I've got my husband's grandmother's recipe. And she was a nice little German lady, and she made a cooked dressing. So it was vinegar-based, but you added the mayo after it was cooked down, and it has a lot of eggs in it. But we always added pickle juice afterwards to kind of zing it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And
that
we always used, yeah, and stone ground mustard.
Okay, so both of them. Susan, thank you so much. There's that pickle juice again. And thinking about cooked dressings, Teresa, or hot potato salad, bacon sometimes makes an appearance. Any suggestions on getting bacon into our potato salad?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the cookbook, the German baked potato salad, I kind of came up with this one based on some classic German potato salad recipes. And then I really love, like, twice-baked potatoes when they've got, you know, cheese in them and baked crispy Ooh. Bacon on top. So in this one, it's got a combination of the really crispy bacon. And I did use in this one a whole grain mustard that's more like a, you know, a German whole grain type of mustard that adds a little bit more flavor and texture to it. So, yeah, I love bacon in just about, you know, anything.
Time for another caller. Russ is on the line in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hi. I'm totally in the vinegar camp. I think I learned, like, this is probably a French style, but Red Yukon were always the best with the skin on. And then when they're hot out of the water, you toss them in a vinaigrette. And then you chill the whole thing down. And when you're ready to serve it, then you add a little mayo, maybe a little mustard and whatever else, like celery or eggs. But you get that vinaigrette soaked into those potatoes while they're hot, and it can be eaten just like that. And another thing is you don't necessarily have to make your own vinaigrette. You could use bottled vinaigrettes from the store, make it really easy. And I always think that's the classic.
Russ, thank you so much for that call. Well, our callers were super interested in this, you guys. I want to ask both of you what your next potato salad is from the book that you would want to eat. Teresa, what's the next one you'd want to make?
Well, since it's so hot here, and I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, it's really hot. I think the Nassau salad, potato salad, and then there's a lemony potato salad with microgreens, anything that's like light and not heavy and has kind of a cool, fresh taste. So both of those would be the two of my favorites.
And Zach, if we were going to cook you one of the potato salad recipes this weekend, what would you want to eat?
I'd want to get that Greek potato salad, the feta, the black olives. It's incredible.
All right. Will there be a sequel, or are you all out of recipes, Teresa?
Oh, no. Since this book, I've thought of probably 50 more. I was like, oh, we should have done that. Oh, we should have done that one.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Zach, it's been good talking to you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Zach Brown and Teresa Blackburn. They're the authors of the book, The Peace, Love, and Potato Salad Cookbook, 24 Delicious Recipes. You can get one of those delicious recipes, by the way, linked at the Central Time Facebook page, the Chipotle Corn Potato Salad. And wow, a lot of you called to talk about potato salad. If you have a favorite type of potato salad, if you come down on one side or the other in the mayo versus vinegar, or we've heard a lot of combos too, actually. If you have a picture of the potato salad you are making for a cookout tonight, let us know over at the Central Time Facebook page. Share your potato salad stories and pick up that recipe for Chipotle Corn Potato Salad out of the new Potato Salad Cookbook. A great controversy is tearing this nation apart, starting arguments in families, at workplaces, and online. It's not election 2016. It's not mayo versus vinegar either. It's the cargo shorts war of 2016. Long story short, there's been a growing online backlash against men wearing cargo shorts, you know, the shorts with all the pockets. A Wall Street Journal reporter blew it open this week. A lot of people, wives, saying they don't want their husbands in them, making fun of them. Producer Chris Molina is with us now wearing what? Cargo shorts.
Cargo,
hey, Chris.
Cargo shorts. Yeah, I think that's why you invited me on today, because this is the one day
I hadn't noticed, honestly,
in like 2 weeks that I wore my cargo shorts. So, of course, we would be talking about this today.
Now, what do you make? I have some cargo shorts. I haven't bought them lately. I wear them around the house mostly. What do you make of this weird backlash against the cargo shorts?
You know, I didn't realize until maybe about a year ago that there was even like a backlash against cargo shorts. I just thought, like, when you go out shopping for men's shorts, like, these were the options that were at the store.
Right.
I mean, they're everywhere. So if you wanted anything else that, you know, wasn't a pair of denim cutoffs, you didn't have too many options. So it was brought to my attention about a year ago. Someone said, maybe not so stylish. And usually I'm not affected by that stuff, but it has affected my wardrobe a little bit.
Wow. Well, I think this is just some internet prankster saying, oh, let's turn people against a random article of clothing. The cargo shorts, let's try that. I think it's all a fraud. Keep wearing those cargo shorts.
All right. I'll wear them on Monday.
All right. Chris, thanks a lot. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.